This is the Cambridge Assessment International Education, Cambridge IGCSE, November 2021 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Exercise 1. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. What does the teacher want students to use to do today's research? B. What information should students present first?
In today's geography lesson, you're going to research a country of your choice. Now, you could look at websites, but actually, there are course books available, and I'd rather you used those. They're from different years, so it'll be interesting to see what's changed in the country you choose. You'll work independently to find out as much as you can, and then present your chosen country to the rest of the class. In your presentations, I'd like you to go into a bit of depth. It's a good idea to start off with facts about population, and then move on to things like the economy or geographical features. Any questions? In today's geography lesson, you're going to research a country of your choice. Now, you could look at websites, but actually, there are course books available, and I'd rather you used those. They're from different years, so it'll be interesting to see what's changed in the country you choose. You'll work independently to find out as much as you can, and then present your chosen country to the rest of the class. In your presentations, I'd like you to go into a bit of depth. It's a good idea to start off with facts about population and then move on to things like the economy or geographical features. Any questions?
Question 2. A. What does the girl most want to see at the science festival? B. What is the name of the activity that the boy wants to do?
Are you going to the science festival at the museum this weekend?
Yeah, I can't wait. There's going to be lots of workshops and talks. It's the energy display that I'm really looking forward to. I think there might be some interactive games too, which is your kind of thing.
Yeah, they should be fun.
Are you going to join in any of the interactive activities? Like the light up badge activity we did last year?
Where we made an electric circuit. Yeah, actually, I've signed up for something called Build a Bridge. It's an engineering competition. There are some cool prizes, apparently.
Oh, really?
Are you going to the science festival at the museum this weekend?
Yeah, I can't wait. There's going to be lots of workshops and talks. It's the energy display that I'm really looking forward to. I think there might be some interactive games too, which is your kind of thing.
Yeah, they should be fun.
Are you going to join in any of the interactive activities? Like the light up badge activity we did last year?
Where we made an electric circuit. Yeah, actually, I've signed up for something called Build a Bridge. It's an engineering competition. There are some cool prizes, apparently.
Oh, really?
Question 3. A. Which water sport will the friends try? B. Where will the friends meet before going to the water sports centre?
Do you fancy heading down to the beach tomorrow afternoon?
Sure. How about going to the water sports centre?
You mean go surfing or sailing? I'm kind of bored of those now. Actually, I wouldn't mind having a go at windsurfing. I've just remembered they're holding a one-day course.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Why not? It'll be more useful than water skiing or whatever.
Great. Shall we meet down at the water sports centre about 2 o'clock? I'll be at the football pitch until one.
How about outside the cafe instead? It won't be as crowded there.
Perfect. See you then. Do you fancy heading down to the beach tomorrow afternoon?
Sure. How about going to the water sports centre?
You mean go surfing or sailing? I'm kind of bored of those now. Actually, I wouldn't mind having a go at windsurfing. I've just remembered they're holding a one-day course.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Why not? It'll be more useful than water skiing or whatever.
Great. Shall we meet down at the water sports centre about 2 o'clock? I'll be at the football pitch until one.
How about outside the cafe instead? It won't be as crowded there.
Perfect. See you then.
Question 4. A. Who is the girl excited about seeing in the film she is going to watch? B. When will the girl have a chance to buy tickets for the film?
Hi, it's Olivia. There's a film on tomorrow evening. Do you want to come? The director's done a few things we've liked. Remember that film called Shadow Boat? He always plays a small part in his own films. Anyway, there's a comedian in it. I can't wait to see her. You'll probably recognise her. Can you let me know and I'll get tickets online? I can do it at lunchtime if you get back to me before then. I'm out this evening and in the morning I'm at college. I don't want to leave it too late or there may be no tickets left. Hi, it's Olivia. There's a film on tomorrow evening. Do you want to come? The director's done a few things we've liked. Remember that film called Shadow Boat? He always plays a small part in his own films. Anyway, there's a comedian in it. I can't wait to see her. You'll probably recognise her. Can you let me know and I'll get tickets online? I can do it at lunchtime if you get back to me before then. I'm out this evening and in the morning I'm at college. I don't want to leave it too late or there may be no tickets left.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 2. You will hear a talk about a tree called the St. Helena gumwood. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Today I'm going to talk about a tree called the St. Helena gumwood. This impressive tree is one of the 10 rarest trees on the planet. It is found only in specific areas on the island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic Ocean. The St. Helena gumwood has a very interesting appearance. Its trunk bends and twists, and its branches create shapes that resemble umbrellas. It has many leaves, which form bunches in the shape of hands. They grow to around 10 centimetres in length and are grey-green in colour. The tree produces small white flowers in both winter and spring. The gumwood only grows at certain altitudes, that's the height above sea level, of between 300 and 600 metres, and each tree takes around 30 years to reach full growth. When the tree is fully grown, it is about 8 metres tall. The tree hasn't always been so rare. At one time, it was the most commonly found species on the island, but problems began when a trading company first settled there. The island's new inhabitants used the trees for fuel, but even greater damage was caused by the goats that they brought with them. They fed on the young trees, stopping them from being able to develop fully. Fortunately, some trees survived. Although other plants were starting to take over the tree's habitat and damage the soil, there were a few trees growing out of cliffs. These were the only trees that were not affected, and so the gumwood didn't disappear from the island completely. In 1980, a conservationist called George Benjamin started trying to reintroduce the St. Helena gumwood to the island. He planted just a handful of young trees and carefully looked after them. Unfortunately, the healthy trees were attacked by insects. These fed on fluid called sap from the trees. This liquid, coming out of the trunks and branches, eventually caused a type of fungus to grow on the trees. Slowly, the new trees began to die. So a type of ladybird was introduced to bring the disease under control. Further planting has been more successful, but there is still a lot to be done for the continued survival of the species. The environment doesn't make it easy for new trees to grow. Although temperatures stay mild all year round and there are no extreme weather patterns, it is often windy, and this badly affects plants and trees. The largest group of trees on the island now is at a place called Peak Dale, where over 500 trees are growing. Other populations are much smaller. Conservationists have also managed to establish trees on the island in school playgrounds, as well as along the edge of the golf course, where they have become an important feature. Wild populations of the tree continue to be affected by other plant species, including ink trees and black olive. Conservationists are continually clearing these plants, as well as weeds, from various sites. They are also collecting gumwood seeds, which means that young trees can be grown in nurseries and then planted in the wild. This will hopefully allow gumwood populations to exist for generations to come.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Today I'm going to talk about a tree called the St. Helena gumwood. This impressive tree is one of the 10 rarest trees on the planet. It is found only in specific areas on the island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic Ocean. The St. Helena gumwood has a very interesting appearance. Its trunk bends and twists, and its branches create shapes that resemble umbrellas. It has many leaves, which form bunches in the shape of hands. They grow to around 10 centimetres in length and are grey-green in colour. The tree produces small white flowers in both winter and spring. The gumwood only grows at certain altitudes, that's the height above sea level, of between 300 and 600 metres, and each tree takes around 30 years to reach full growth. When the tree is fully grown, it is about 8 metres tall. The tree hasn't always been so rare. At one time, it was the most commonly found species on the island, but problems began when a trading company first settled there. The island's new inhabitants used the trees for fuel, but even greater damage was caused by the goats that they brought with them. They fed on the young trees, stopping them from being able to develop fully. Fortunately, some trees survived. Although other plants were starting to take over the tree's habitat and damage the soil, there were a few trees growing out of cliffs. These were the only trees that were not affected, and so the gumwood didn't disappear from the island completely. In 1980, a conservationist called George Benjamin started trying to reintroduce the St. Helena gumwood to the island. He planted just a handful of young trees and carefully looked after them. Unfortunately, the healthy trees were attacked by insects. These fed on fluid called sap from the trees. This liquid, coming out of the trunks and branches, eventually caused a type of fungus to grow on the trees. Slowly, the new trees began to die. So a type of ladybird was introduced to bring the disease under control. Further planting has been more successful, but there is still a lot to be done for the continued survival of the species. The environment doesn't make it easy for new trees to grow. Although temperatures stay mild all year round and there are no extreme weather patterns, it is often windy, and this badly affects plants and trees. The largest group of trees on the island now is at a place called Peak Dale, where over 500 trees are growing. Other populations are much smaller. Conservationists have also managed to establish trees on the island in school playgrounds, as well as along the edge of the golf course, where they have become an important feature. Wild populations of the tree continue to be affected by other plant species, including ink trees and black olive. Conservationists are continually clearing these plants, as well as weeds, from various sites. They are also collecting gumwood seeds, which means that young trees can be grown in nurseries and then planted in the wild. This will hopefully allow gumwood populations to exist for generations to come.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment you will hear exercise 3. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 3. You will hear 6 people talking about working outdoors. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recording twice. Speaker 1.
I'm a dairy farmer and keep cows for milk. The aspect of the job I find particularly tricky is looking out for signs of illness. But there are fantastic farm vets I can rely on. It's not easy getting up very early in the morning to bring the cows in for milking, especially when it's dark or cold and raining. But despite the tiredness, I manage to take care of these gentle giants. And nothing beats the sounds and smells you get in the countryside, especially first thing when everyone else is still in bed.
Speaker 2.
As a cycling instructor, I appreciate being able to look at the architecture of London where I work. I know the city well and could never go back to using underground trains. It feels too closed in down there. I didn't realise until I started cycling everywhere how much I love open space and knowing I can go anywhere. Sometimes the roads can be busy, and kids I teach complain about having to go out when it's cold or wet, but they're fine once they've got used to it.
Speaker 3.
I design parks and other green spaces in cities with wildlife conservation in mind. The idea is to provide habitats for birds and other small creatures, but I want people to enjoy them too. I'm passionate about the outdoors. It's my whole reason for being. I want everyone to engage with nature and to feel the calm and relaxation that I experience simply from being surrounded by nature. I'm just a tiny part of a bigger picture, the never-ending cycle of the seasons. It's a very satisfying job to do.
Speaker 4.
As an agricultural worker, I'm out in the fields day in, day out, rain or shine. It's no easy task. One minute I'm planting the land, and the next I'm harvesting the crops, collecting them from the ground. It's highly rewarding, realizing that something that started as a tiny plant can become healthy food for people. Work in the fields is seasonal, but during winter I keep occupied by fixing fences, servicing machinery, and so on. It keeps me fit too, though I do sometimes complain about an aching back.
Speaker 5.
I work as a tree specialist, making sure trees which line the roads are cared for and don't affect the public. A branch hanging low could get in people's way, or a diseased branch might affect the tree's overall health. I spend loads of time up amongst branches, and I get fascinating views of the areas I work in. Only I get to look down at people walking below me. It's challenging work, and it can be freezing in winter, but there are advantages too.
Speaker 6.
I'm an outdoor activity instructor working with young people. I take them into the fields to learn about things like wildflowers. I also get them involved in making campfires or building shelters from things they find. It gets them moving. Often they like the idea of the outdoors and already spend time outside when it's dry, but when they're out and about and it starts raining, they hate it. Thankfully, I enjoy being outside whatever it's like, and when they notice that, they just tend to get on with things.
Now you will hear the 6 speakers again. Speaker 1.
I'm a dairy farmer and keep cows for milk. The aspect of the job I find particularly tricky is looking out for signs of illness. But there are fantastic farm vets I can rely on. It's not easy getting up very early in the morning to bring the cows in for milking, especially when it's dark or cold and raining. But despite the tiredness, I manage to take care of these gentle giants, and nothing beats the sounds and smells you get in the countryside, especially first thing when everyone else is still in bed.
Speaker 2.
As a cycling instructor, I appreciate being able to look at the architecture of London where I work. I know the city well and could never go back to using underground trains. It feels too closed in down there. I didn't realise until I started cycling everywhere how much I love open space and knowing I can go anywhere. Sometimes the roads can be busy, and kids I teach complain about having to go out when it's cold or wet, but they're fine once they've got used to it.
Speaker 3.
I design parks and other green spaces in cities with wildlife conservation in mind. The idea is to provide habitats for birds and other small creatures, but I want people to enjoy them too. I'm passionate about the outdoors. It's my whole reason for being. I want everyone to engage with nature and to feel the calm and relaxation that I experience simply from being surrounded by nature. I'm just a tiny part of a bigger picture, the never-ending cycle of the seasons. It's a very satisfying job to do.
Speaker 4.
As an agricultural worker, I'm out in the fields day in, day out, rain or shine. It's no easy task. One minute I'm planting the land, and the next I'm harvesting the crops, collecting them from the ground. It's highly rewarding, realizing that something that started as a tiny plant can become healthy food for people. Work in the fields is seasonal, but during winter I keep occupied by fixing fences, servicing machinery, and so on. It keeps me fit too, though I do sometimes complain about an aching back.
Speaker 5.
I work as a tree specialist, making sure trees which line the roads are cared for and don't affect the public. A branch hanging low could get in people's way, or a diseased branch might affect the tree's overall health. I spend loads of time up amongst branches, and I get fascinating views of the areas I work in. Only I get to look down at people walking below me. It's challenging work, and it can be freezing in winter, but there are advantages too.
Speaker 6.
I'm an outdoor activity instructor working with young people. I take them into the fields to learn about things like wildflowers. I also get them involved in making campfires or building shelters from things they find. It gets them moving. Often they like the idea of the outdoors and already spend time outside when it's dry, but when they're out and about and it starts raining, they hate it. Thankfully, I enjoy being outside whatever it's like, and when they notice that, they just tend to get on with things.
That is the end of exercise 3. In a moment you will hear exercise 4. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 4. You will hear an interview with a young chef called Danny Bowes about a competition she entered. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Today, we're talking to the winner of the Young Chef Competition, Danny Bowes. Tell us about the competition.
Well, the idea is to find the chefs of the future. The competition's meant to inspire young people to enter the industry, which hasn't been getting enough new talent. I thought I had the ability to do okay, and maybe learn something too, though my primary objective's never been to own my own restaurant, which some competitors wanted to do.
How did you enter the competition?
In the first stage, everyone submitted a four-course menu for consideration. We had a budget and had to reveal our character in the dishes, as well as prove the food had come from ethical sources. We also had to make sure nothing was thrown away. That was where I had to really think, though I didn't have to adapt what I call my signature dishes. They represent my keenness to experiment and have unusual flavour combinations.
And you got through to the second stage.
Right. That involved cooking a dish for the judges. We prepared our dishes in the kitchen of an actual restaurant. Everyone was friendly and we chatted about how long we'd been cooking. As I'd suspected, many of them had been cooking for longer than me, but I put that out of my mind because worrying affects your chances of succeeding, and I really knew my dish because I'd practiced it so many times.
You made a specialty pizza. Did everything go to plan?
Not exactly. I was relieved to find no one was doing dishes anything like mine, so there was no threat of anyone making the same thing. I realised as I was about to start cooking that the pizza stone I wanted to cook it on, which helps prevent burning, was in the back of Mum's car, and she'd gone home after dropping me off. Anyway, the oven did the job just as well.
How did it go when you presented your dish to the judges?
Well, there were three of them, including a famous TV chef who I have a lot of respect for. I only just managed to hide my nerves. It was tense watching the judges taste the food. Their faces completely lacked expression, so I had no idea whether they liked it. Time seemed to stop while we hung on for their decisions. That was probably when I most felt the pressure. But they loved my dish and I won.
Congratulations. Tell us about the way the judges rated your performance.
They gave marks for technical skills, creativity, and personal beliefs about food and cooking. I have strong views. Education's the key to healthy eating and sustainable food, so I had no problem answering some in-depth questions. I scored worst on technical ability, which was unexpected because I thought I'd done everything right. I was actually more concerned they wouldn't think pizza was inventive enough, even though I adapted the traditional style, but they praised my idea.
Did the judges give you any advice?
They told all the competitors that although we'd all done well in producing our individual dishes, we shouldn't think there's nothing left to learn. Before you focus on fancy ways of doing things, you need to understand how to get even things that seem simple 100% perfect. I really paid attention to that. I already knew most chefs begin in junior positions, for example, preparing vegetables and cleaning up. And of course, you've got to put the hours in if you want to make progress in the profession.
What's next for you?
I need to decide between catering college or finding a job in a kitchen. I've pretty much decided on the former, as I'd like to have more to add to my CV, despite winning the competition. People keep asking if I'm going to enter more, but I've proved to myself I can make a career of cooking and that's enough for me. There are some great prizes to be won, but it's someone else's turn now.
Thanks, Danny.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today, we're talking to the winner of the Young Chef Competition, Danny Bowes. Tell us about the competition.
Well, the idea is to find the chefs of the future. The competition's meant to inspire young people to enter the industry, which hasn't been getting enough new talent. I thought I had the ability to do okay, and maybe learn something too, though my primary objective's never been to own my own restaurant, which some competitors wanted to do.
How did you enter the competition?
In the first stage, everyone submitted a four-course menu for consideration. We had a budget and had to reveal our character in the dishes, as well as prove the food had come from ethical sources. We also had to make sure nothing was thrown away. That was where I had to really think. Though I didn't have to adapt what I call my signature dishes. They represent my keenness to experiment and have unusual flavour combinations.
And you got through to the second stage.
Right. That involved cooking a dish for the judges. We prepared our dishes in the kitchen of an actual restaurant. Everyone was friendly and we chatted about how long we'd been cooking. As I'd suspected, many of them had been cooking for longer than me, but I put that out of my mind because worrying affects your chances of succeeding, and I really knew my dish because I'd practiced it so many times.
You made a specialty pizza. Did everything go to plan?
Not exactly. I was relieved to find no one was doing dishes anything like mine, so there was no threat of anyone making the same thing. I realised as I was about to start cooking that the pizza stone I wanted to cook it on, which helps prevent burning, was in the back of Mum's car and she'd gone home after dropping me off. Anyway, the oven did the job just as well.
How did it go when you presented your dish to the judges?
Well, there were three of them, including a famous TV chef who I have a lot of respect for. I only just managed to hide my nerves. It was tense watching the judges taste the food. Their faces completely lacked expression, so I had no idea whether they liked it. Time seemed to stop while we hung on for their decisions. That was probably when I most felt the pressure. But they loved my dish and I won.
Congratulations. Tell us about the way the judges rated your performance.
They gave marks for technical skills, creativity, and personal beliefs about food and cooking. I have strong views. Education's the key to healthy eating and sustainable food, so I had no problem answering some in-depth questions. I scored worst on technical ability, which was unexpected because I thought I'd done everything right. I was actually more concerned they wouldn't think pizza was inventive enough, even though I adapted the traditional style, but they praised my idea.
Did the judges give you any advice?
They told all the competitors that although we'd all done well in producing our individual dishes, we shouldn't think there's nothing left to learn. Before you focus on fancy ways of doing things, you need to understand how to get even things that seem simple 100% perfect. I really paid attention to that. I already knew most chefs begin in junior positions, for example, preparing vegetables and cleaning up. And of course, you've got to put the hours in if you want to make progress in the profession.
What's next for you?
I need to decide between catering college or finding a job in a kitchen. I've pretty much decided on the former, as I'd like to have more to add to my CV, despite winning the competition. People keep asking if I'm going to enter more, but I've proved to myself I can make a career of cooking and that's enough for me. There are some great prizes to be won, but it's someone else's turn now.
Thanks, Danny.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear exercise 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 5, Part A. You will hear an expedition leader giving a talk about expeditions for young people. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Good afternoon. I'm Amy from the Explorers Society and I'm an expedition leader. We're a youth development charity, and we take young people, just like you, on expeditions. Our expeditions are not like holiday resorts by the beach. There's deserts, jungles, you name it. But what they have in common is how remote they are. You'll find the activities you do on our expeditions both challenging and highly rewarding, as you'll meet new people, visit places, and learn a wide range of new skills. Participants are carefully chosen to join an expedition based on their particular abilities. To get a place, participants don't need any previous expedition experience, but everyone needs to be prepared to commit to the training and to raise funds. There is no application form or anything like that. Instead, young people are invited to selection weekends, which is the best way of finding out if they have got what it takes. Occasionally, telephone conversations can be arranged instead, though these are less than ideal. Our expeditions take participants out of their comfort zone, where normal rules do not apply. We believe that by stretching yourself, you can transform your life. Before leaving, you come up with your own personal development goals, which typically include things like learning how to deal with difficult situations and make decisions. By the end, you'll be ready to make the most of your future. Our leaders act as role models and guides and equip young explorers with a wide range of skills, which not only enable them to take part in research and media projects, but may encourage them to perhaps one day become a leader of some kind themselves. It doesn't matter where you start out. Everyone's got potential to grow. Leaders are friendly and supportive, and above all, they believe safety to be incredibly important. So, if this is your first trip without your parents, neither you nor they need to worry. So, what have previous participants said about our expeditions? Well, many of them say that after their expedition, they find teamwork has become less of a challenge, though virtually everyone who's taken part comments that their communication has improved. So, if you've got what it takes to be a young explorer, come and take a look at the range of expeditions we offer.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Good afternoon. I'm Amy from the Explorers Society, and I'm an expedition leader. We're a youth development charity, and we take young people, just like you, on expeditions. Our expeditions are not like holiday resorts by the beach. There's deserts, jungles, you name it. But what they have in common is how remote they are. You'll find the activities you do on our expeditions both challenging and highly rewarding, as you'll meet new people, visit places, and learn a wide range of new skills. Participants are carefully chosen to join an expedition based on their particular abilities. To get a place, participants don't need any previous expedition experience, but everyone needs to be prepared to commit to the training and to raise funds. There is no application form or anything like that. Instead, young people are invited to selection weekends, which is the best way of finding out if they have got what it takes. Occasionally, telephone conversations can be arranged instead, though these are less than ideal. Our expeditions take participants out of their comfort zone, where normal rules do not apply. We believe that by stretching yourself, you can transform your life. Before leaving, you come up with your own personal development goals, which typically include things like learning how to deal with difficult situations and make decisions. By the end, you'll be ready to make the most of your future. Our leaders act as role models and guides and equip young explorers with a wide range of skills, which not only enable them to take part in research and media projects, but may encourage them to perhaps one day become a leader of some kind themselves. It doesn't matter where you start out. Everyone's got potential to grow. Leaders are friendly and supportive, and above all, they believe safety to be incredibly important. So, if this is your first trip without your parents, neither you nor they need to worry. So, what have previous participants said about our expeditions? Well, many of them say that after their expedition, they find teamwork has become less of a challenge, though virtually everyone who's taken part comments that their communication has improved. So, if you've got what it takes to be a young explorer, come and take a look at the range of expeditions we offer.
Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two young people about an expedition to the Himalayan mountains and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
I'm definitely thinking about joining one of those expeditions. Did you look at the trips they do? They're amazing!
Yeah, I know. I really liked the look of the one in the Himalayan mountains. It sounds like participants learn loads of new stuff.
Like mountaineering skills.
We'd get to carry out data collection too.
I think the information said we'd go to the third highest weather station in the world to do that.
Imagine how great that would be.
I know what you mean.
And some of the other locations we'd visit sound spectacular. I've never seen Himalayan wildflowers. They looked amazing in those photos we saw.
And as long as the winds aren't too strong, or there's not a whiteout where you can't see anything but cloud or whatever, we'd get to cross ice fields as well. That would be really great. So few people go to these places.
And the chance to spot the wildlife that lives in the mountains sounds incredible. Wasn't there something called the Himalayan blue sheep?
It looks more like a deer to me. Sounds like there's a decent chance of seeing those.
I'd love to see a snow leopard. It doesn't sound very likely, though. They're tricky to track down as they're afraid of humans.
Right. One thing I wouldn't want to come face to face with is a bear, but I wouldn't mind seeing one from a distance.
The camp sounds good, too. Sitting round the fire, listening to the guides tell stories about their adventures.
And hopefully talking about our own, if we go. I reckon we'd need to carry a fair amount of equipment and warm clothes with us. It won't be warm at high altitudes.
And we'd have to put up our tents each night. I read that participants also have to take turns making meals as well.
We'd all join in, I guess. And apparently, the guides will make sure cooking facilities are in place, so we wouldn't need to worry about that.
Do you think it'd be as hard as that speaker said?
Probably. It seemed like he was making sure we understood that. I was surprised to hear we'd need a medical certificate, you know, to prove that we're fit and healthy enough to cope with it all.
And then get a visa, right?
They'd do that for us. And sort out the flight, too.
Oh, good.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
I'm definitely thinking about joining one of those expeditions. Did you look at the trips they do? They're amazing!
Yeah, I know. I really liked the look of the one in the Himalayan mountains. It sounds like participants learn loads of new stuff.
Like mountaineering skills.
We'd get to carry out data collection too. I think the information said we'd go to the third highest weather station in the world to do that.
Imagine how great that would be.
I know what you mean.
And some of the other locations we'd visit sound spectacular. I've never seen Himalayan wildflowers. They looked amazing in those photos we saw.
And as long as the winds aren't too strong, or there's not a whiteout where you can't see anything but cloud or whatever, we'd get to cross ice fields as well. That would be really great. So few people go to these places.
And the chance to spot the wildlife that lives in the mountains sounds incredible. Wasn't there something called the Himalayan blue sheep?
It looks more like a deer to me. Sounds like there's a decent chance of seeing those.
I'd love to see a snow leopard. It doesn't sound very likely, though. They're tricky to track down as they're afraid of humans.
Right. One thing I wouldn't want to come face to face with is a bear, but I wouldn't mind seeing one from a distance.
The camp sounds good, too. Sitting round the fire, listening to the guides tell stories about their adventures.
And hopefully talking about our own, if we go. I reckon we'd need to carry a fair amount of equipment and warm clothes with us. It won't be warm at high altitudes.
And we'd have to put up our tents each night. I read that participants also have to take turns making meals as well.
We'd all join in, I guess. And apparently, the guides will make sure cooking facilities are in place, so we wouldn't need to worry about that.
Do you think it'd be as hard as that speaker said?
Probably. It seemed like he was making sure we understood that. I was surprised to hear we'd need a medical certificate, you know, to prove that we're fit and healthy enough to cope with it all.
And then get a visa, right?
They'd do that for us. And sort out the flight, too.
Oh, good.
That is the end of Exercise 5. and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.